welcome to the reading of the Des Moines Register for Friday, May 29th, 2020. I'm your reader, Dennis May. Things are changing very quickly, and IRIS wants to make sure we provide our listeners with as much information as we can. In order to do that, we've changed our program schedule completely. This schedule will air statewide on all platforms until further notice. We will also include information about resources in your community during each paper. You'll still hear your Des Moines Register each day at 9 a.m., 6 p.m., and 1 a.m. Please listen closely to the following changes for all other newspapers. The Fort Dodge Messenger will be read at 7 a.m. Monday through Friday. The Mason City Globe Gazette will be read at 8 a.m. Monday through Friday. Your Des Moines Register will continue to be read from 9 a.m. until noon. The Cedar Rapids Gazette will be read at noon, 7 days a week. The Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier will be read at 1 p.m., 7 days a week. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald will be read at 2 p.m. Monday through Friday. The Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil will be read at 3 p.m. Monday through Friday. The Sioux City Journal will be read at 4 p.m. 7 days a week. The Ames Tribune will be read at 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. The Midwick Shopping Cart will be read each Wednesday at 9 p.m. Recordings of all newspapers will be available on our podcast page. Just go to iowaradioreading.org, click Listen Now, then click Listen to IRIS Podcasts. The papers are organized by region. Each paper will be available for 7 days. As things continue to change, we will announce schedule changes each hour at 56 minutes past the hour going forward. Keep yourselves safe, and thank you for listening. Now let's take a look at today's weather. It will be breezy and less humid today with clouds and sun. Partly cloudy tonight. Mostly cloudy tomorrow with a shower or thunderstorm in the area in the afternoon. Sunday and Monday will be times of clouds and sun. In the Des Moines area today, expect a high of 72 with a low of 52. Breezy and less humid, clouds and sun, partly cloudy tonight. On Saturday, a high of 67 with a low of 51, and mostly cloudy. Sunday, a high of 68 with a low of 60, and times of clouds and sun. Across the area today, breezy and less humid with clouds and sun, winds north-northwest from 10 to 20 miles per hour. On Saturday, mostly cloudy with a shower or thunderstorm in the area in the afternoon, with the winds from the north at 4 to 8 miles per hour. Our sunrise today is 5:44 a.m. and will set at 8:40 p.m. The moonrise today at 12:10 p.m. and it will set at 1:50 a.m. And now let's take a look at the first story in today's Des Moines Register. Jailer files suit, says he was fired. He had notified state of COVID-19 case. A Dallas County correctional officer was fired after he reported to state officials a plan to bring back to work an employee who had tested positive for COVID-19 while on the job at the county jail, according to a wrongful termination lawsuit filed this week. Dustin Robbins said in the lawsuit that he and some of his co-workers at the jail became concerned when, on May 2nd, sheriff officials informed them via email that the jail employee was not symptomatic and would be returning to work with precautions. The email, obtained by the Des Moines Register, did not say how long it had been since the worker was diagnosed. Robbins said in an interview that concerned him and that he did not feel as though he could approach the sheriff about his worries. The May 26 suit said Robbins reported the plan to the Iowa Department of Corrections hotline on May 4th. Within an hour, it said, jail officials notified employees that the infected worker would not be coming back after all. Dallas County Sheriff Chad Leonard held a staff meeting the following day with state health officials present. During the staff meeting, Robbins voiced his concern about possible infection, according to the lawsuit. Leonard and jail administrator Douglas Land called Robbins into a private meeting later that day and accused him of being disrespectful at the staff meeting, according to the suit. Leonard and Land declined to comment for this article, citing the ongoing litigation as well as being limited as what they can discuss about personal matters. The lawsuit says Leonard was upset that Robbins had gone over his head by calling state officials about his concerns. In a recording of the meeting Robbins made and shared with the Register, Robbins did not immediately acknowledge that he was the caller. "I don't care that you called, but why didn't you just freaking ask?" I was asking. "Why didn't you man up and ask?" Leonard's is heard telling Robbins on the recording. The conversation grew progressively more heated, with cursing between Land and Roberts. Robbins ultimately acknowledged that he had called the state hotline, which was established to help law enforcement agencies field questions and concerns from the public about correctional facilities during the pandemic. Land reacted angrily on the recording. "Grow some balls, Dustin. If you've got a problem with what we're effing doing or what you're hearing, come to us first instead of being a little bee calling out people," he is heard saying. Robbins can be heard asking Leonard whether he would allow the jail administrator to speak to another employee in that matter. Leonard responded by telling Robbins to leave, saying, "Don't you ever come back." Robbins then asked whether he was being fired. Leonard said he would call him and that, quote, "you're off on leave," end quote. Robbins said in the lawsuit that he received no further communications until a May 12 email from a Dallas County Human Resources representative notifying him that he had been terminated for, quote, "no call, no show," end quote. Dallas County officials conclude Robbins had voluntarily resigned from his job, he said in the lawsuit. The suit contends that the termination violates a law prohibiting Iowa government officials from discharging an employee who discloses information about a situation that the worker believes poses a danger to the public, health, or safety. It also claims the termination violates Iowa public policy that prohibits retaliation against whistleblowers. Iowa Department of Correction officials did not immediately respond Thursday to questions related to the hotline and Robbins' case. The online description of the hotline does not indicate whether calls are considered confidential. Melissa Hassel, Robbins' attorney, said she believes violations occurred regardless of whether the hotline guarantees anonymity. "The whole purpose of the Iowa Law and Whistleblower Protection Policy is to prevent exactly what we have alleged happened here, where an employee is afraid to go to their direct department," Hassel said. He tried to anonymously report this to the Department of Corrections for the good of the department, and it came back to bite him. Robbins was paid $18.21 an hour and had worked for the department for about a year. He seeks to be reinstated to his job, given back pay, compensated for his attorney fees, and awarded civil damages up to 3 times his annual salary. The spread of coronavirus in jails and prisons has been a widespread concern among public health advocates. At least 29,251 COVID-19 cases have been confirmed in prisons across the country, according to the Marshall Project, a nonprofit criminal justice news outlet. At least 23 inmates and 16 staffers at Iowa prisons have tested positive for the disease. Iowa jail coronavirus cases are not being reported in daily statistics released by the Iowa Department of Public Health, but some local agencies update their case counts. As of Wednesday, 2 Dallas County sheriff employees had tested positive for COVID-19. One has returned to work, and the other is waiting for approval to return. "No Dallas County jail inmates have tested positive," Leonard said Wednesday. At least 109 inmates and 9 staffers at the Polk County Jail have tested positive for the disease. Robbins this week said he believes his concerns remain valid, noting that people with COVID-19 can spread the virus despite showing no symptoms. "I immediately, right off the bat, didn't think it was appropriate. Didn't think it was being handled properly," Robbins said. "And I know that I wasn't the only one feeling that way about the situation." And also from the front page, group says producer roasted pigs alive. A California animal rights group says an Iowa pork producer, quote, "roasted pigs alive," end quote, when it euthanized thousands of hogs it was unable to send to Midwest meatpacking plants that had slowed or halted production as workers fell ill with COVID-19. Direct Action Everywhere describes the pigs as, quote, "shrieking in agony" after Iowa Select Farms, a large pork producer, shut down the ventilation in a rural confinement facility near Amplington in Grundy County to euthanize them. Jeff Hansen, the company's CEO, said it, quote, "exhausted every possible option," end quote, from finding more barn space to donating pork to food banks and employees before deciding to euthanize the animals. "Employees are in tremendous pain knowing that this awful decision had to be made," Hansen said. Direct Action Everywhere said it worked with Iowa Select whistleblowers to secretly film company employees destroying the animals. The company confirmed the video was taken at the Grundy Center facility where Iowa Select pigs were taken to be destroyed. "This group illegally infiltrated our facility and installed cameras to record video of the euthanasia process and our team members," Hansen said in a statement, adding that the group's actions only reinforced the hurt felt by employees. The video, which the group said was taken with a hidden camera last week, opens with a shot of pigs milling in a large enclosed space. In another scene shot through a fog that the group says was steam, the barely visible pigs can be heard squealing. In a third scene, two men carrying what the group says are bolt guns walk among the apparently dead pigs, nudging them with their feet. In a final scene, a front-end loader scoops up the carcasses. The state estimates that 600,000 pigs in Iowa could be destroyed as they back up on farms that cannot be processed into food. Iowa, the nation's largest pork producer, raises about 50 million pigs a year. Iowa Agriculture Secretary Mike Nagy called the activist's tactics disgusting. No producer wants to be faced with this decision. It goes against everything they stand for and do on a daily basis, caring for the animals and raising them to feed families, Nagy said Thursday when asked about the video during a press conference with Governor Kim Reynolds about the coronavirus impact. We have folks with a clear agenda who are kicking our farmers when they're down, he said, adding that the producers are working with veterinarians who follow national guidelines when euthanizing animals. The American Association of Swine Veterinarians says shutting down a confinement's ventilation, which raises the herd's temperature and causes animals to die of hyperthermia, is an acceptable form of euthanasia in constrained circumstances. The group's board this month identified the COVID-19 meatpacking disruption as one of those situations, but the board said priority should be given to 8 other preferred methods, including shooting, electrocution, gassing with carbon dioxide, and manual blunt force, which is used primarily on small pigs. Chris Rademacher, an Iowa State University Extension swine veterinarian, said shutting down ventilation is likely the best approach to euthanizing a large number of pigs. It's safer for farmers than shooting, electrocution, or using other preferred methods, which are more appropriate options when euthanizing a small number of animals, he said. Rademacher also said mass depopulation takes less toll on farmers emotionally. I can't tell you how many producers get choked up talking about euthanizing animals, he said. Matt Johnson, the Direct Action Everywhere investigator, filed a complaint last week with the Grundy County Sheriff's Office, alleging Iowa Select committed criminal animal neglect. Grundy County Sheriff Rick Penning said he talked with state veterinarian Jeff Kazad, who indicated that Iowa Select followed proper procedures in euthanizing the animals. Penning said he would not take further action on the group's complaint. However, after filing their complaint last week, Johnson of Berkeley, California, and co-worker Linda Cridge of Fishers, Indiana, were charged with trespassing, a simple misdemeanor. The two face fines of $335 each. A veterinarian who works with Direct Action Everywhere and reviewed the group's video said shutting down the ventilation resulted in extreme, prolonged, and unnecessary suffering. The group said that pigs are blasted with steam and heat exceeding 140 degrees in a barn. 2 or 3 hours into the process, the group said, Iowa Select workers walked through the barn, shooting pigs exhibiting obvious signs of life with bolt guns. The American Veterinary Medical Association states that additional action may be needed to ensure pigs succumb after shutting down ventilation systems, such as adding heat and humidity to the confined space. Rademacher said the pigs should quickly lose consciousness with the increased heat and humidity before dying. The Iowa Department of Agriculture sent a letter to the state's county attorneys this week saying that it is not uncommon for people to question the methods employed in the challenging situation. It said the Swine Veterinarians Association recognizes the dire situation producers face. Johnson said an Iowa Select whistleblower contacted Direct Action Everywhere because he was concerned about animal welfare. When we have a system that is fundamentally broken, with government reinforcing rather than regulating, an abusive industry which only serves those at the very top, it's left to ordinary people to take action, ourselves, and hold our elected officials accountable to the will of the people, Johnson said in a statement. He and Direct Action Everywhere targeted State Senator Ken Rosenboom's family pig facility for an undercover investigation a year ago, releasing photos and video from the Oskaloosa farm in January. The group said it sought to expose inhumane treatment of animals at the facility, which was leased to another farmer, because of Rosenboom's support for the state's so-called egg-egg law. The statute makes it a crime for animal welfare activists, journalists, and others to go undercover at meatpacking plants and livestock facilities to document conditions. Rosenboom called the action, quote, a professional hit job, end quote. State and local investigators said a complaint Johnson filed against Rosenboom, alleging animal abuse, was unfounded. And the final story on today's Des Moines Register front page, Iowa could see record primary voting in pandemic. Iowa could experience record turnout in this year's June 2nd primary, but that doesn't mean voters should expect long Election Day lines at the polls. A contested U.S. Senate primary leads the Democratic side of the statewide ballot. There are competitive Republican primaries in the 2nd and 4th congressional districts, but the marquee races are not all that's expected to drive turnout to record levels. Instead, the coronavirus pandemic, which makes it less comfortable for Iowans to vote in person, has helped make it easier for people to vote. Early voting by mail has spiked after Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate, a Republican, mailed absentee ballot request forms to every registered voter in the state to encourage people to vote safely. As of Thursday, nearly 500,000 Iowans had requested absentee ballots, and more than 300,000 had already voted early by mail. If the remaining requested ballots are returned, and history says most of them will be, Iowa will break its primary turnout record of 449,490 set in 1994, regardless of what happens on Election Day. As many absentees as we've had, I'm nervous that our poll workers might be bored on Election Day, said Amanda Waske, the Ringgold County Auditor. Boredom is part of the plan. Election officials say they're confident the early voting push will help Iowa avoid the long lines and poll worker shortages that have caused chaos in other state primaries this year as voters went to the polls during the pandemic. In Wisconsin's April primary, a shortage of poll workers and a sharply reduced number of polling places meant some voters had to spend hours in line to cast their ballots. Some Milwaukee residents waited for up to 2.5 hours to vote after the city reduced its 180 polling places to 5. Iowa auditors are also consolidating polling places in advance of the June 2nd primary, but they don't expect the lines that brought chaos to Wisconsin. We're comfortable that with the successful response we've seen from the absentee ballot effort, that we have enough polling sites and we have enough polling workers to be able to assure Iowa voters that it's safe to go to vote if they choose to do so in person on June 2nd, Pate said. Those who do not vote in person June 2nd will find extra health safety measures in place. Many counties will have social distancing markers at polling places to keep people 6 feet apart, make masks available to voters, require masks for staff, and mandate that surfaces be wiped down. County officials have even worked to buy enough pens so every voter can take theirs with them to avoid reuse. The Secretary of State's office sent personal protective equipment, such as masks, face shields, gloves, and hand sanitizer, to officials in all 99 counties. Iowa paid for the equipment using a portion of the $4 million in federal funds it received from Congress to assist with elections during the coronavirus pandemic. The state also gave out $500,000 in grants to help counties prepare for the elections. Those funds also help pay for the state's effort to recruit younger poll workers, since many regular poll workers are older and fall into high-risk categories for coronavirus. Waske said her poll workers will include a mix of college students home for the summer, teachers, and some of her regular poll workers who decided to return. Since many counties consolidated polling sites to ensure they will have enough poll workers at each, voters may find themselves voting in a new place. Johnson County has dropped from the 57 sites it has had since the 2010 census to 46 this year, while Scott County has gone from 63 to 23. Ringgold County, which is much smaller, has gone from 7 sites to 5, and Grundy County has dropped from 7 sites to 3. Polk County, the most populous in the state, has gone from 135 polling places to just 28. Polk County Auditor Jamie Fitzgerald said he looked to historical turnout when deciding which sites to consolidate, and then tried to pick locations that would make sense to voters. The county also has a website, PolkElectionIA.gov, that gives voters turn-by-turn directions to their polling places. The Secretary of State's office also has a website, VoteReady.Iowa.gov, to allow people to track their absentee ballots and find their polling place. County officials have also made extra efforts to accommodate early voting, both in person and by mail. Iowa is required to offer in-person early voting, but with courthouses and county offices closed to the public in many counties, auditors have gotten creative. In Johnson County, Auditor Travis Weipert set up a tent outside the county administration building to create a drive-through voting setup. His office even borrowed a speed trailer from the sheriff's office, so voters are greeted with a flashing voting straight ahead sign when they pull into the parking lot. When cars pull up, staff come out in full protective gear and give voters the ballots. In Grundy County, where the courthouse is closed, Auditor Rhonda Dieters said residents can show up, call the office, and staff will come out and allow voters to cast their ballots curbside. The courthouse is also closed in Ringgold County, except for a conference room near one entrance that can be isolated from the rest of the building. That's where Roski says the county set up its early voting site for the few dozen who have taken advantage of it. We do have social distancing stickers on the floor so people know where they can stand and where they can't. But honestly, we've maybe only once or twice had two people in at one time, she said. It's handling the high volume of absentee ballots that has kept auditors busy. Fitzgerald said Polk County bought two high-speed letter openers to help staff quickly count the high number of absentee ballots that have come in the mail. As of Thursday, Iowans have returned 65% of the total requested absentee ballots. If Iowans return their ballots at a similar rate as the last three state primaries, 91% in 2018, 86% in 2016, and 91% in 2014, the state will fall just shy of the record primary turnout even if no one votes on Election Day. With Election Day voting, the record could still be broken. After the primary, Pate said his office will review the measures he took, including the decision to send absentee ballot request forms to registered voters, to see what worked well. But he said it's too early to say if he'll do the same thing for the general election in November. President Donald Trump has taken to criticize Democratic-led states that have taken similar steps. But Pate said the decision to send voter ballot request forms wasn't based on politics, but on the advice of election professionals. Iowa's absentee voting system has been in place for years and is secure, he said. Pate said he has the authority he needs under current Iowa law to ensure November's elections run smoothly, but he said he's sure that when the legislature returns for its normal session in January 2021, his office will work with lawmakers to make improvements. Meanwhile, some county auditors say they would like the effort to continue in November. Auditors across the state are just requesting that we keep the same plan in place that we're using for primary also for the general, Woski said. That plan includes expanding the early voting period for mailed ballots from 29 days to 40, sending absentee request forms to registered voters, and providing ample protective equipment. Although he expects Iowa to have enough poll workers for the June primary, Pate said he intends to ramp up poll worker recruitment efforts ahead of November, since turnout will be higher. Another challenge will be finding polling locations. Officials at many private sites, such as churches that often serve as polling places, weren't comfortable hosting voting during the pandemic. Pate said it helped that schools have been closed, so they are easily being used instead, but that may not be the case in November. We'll have to be very aggressive on looking for polling locations, and we're going to need more poll workers because in the fall election you do have 60-70% voter turnout. Even with an aggressive absentee effort, you're still going to have a lot of people coming out, and we certainly again want to avoid lines, Pate said. Scott County Auditor Roxana Moritz said she believes the two most important things heading into November will be guidance from the state and educating Iowans so that they know all the ways they can vote. As we have a national conversation and a state conversation, auditors in the state need to know what that guidance is going to be and where we're headed, she said. Iowans to march in honor of Floyd. Residents react to 46-year-old's death involving police. The death of George Floyd, a 46-year-old black man who died Monday after a Minneapolis police officer held his knee on Floyd's neck for several minutes, has resulted in violent protests in Minnesota and has ignited conversations about race across the country, including in Iowa. One group, Mothers Against Violence, announced it would hold a march Saturday starting at 1 p.m. near East 14th Street and University Avenue in Des Moines. As of Thursday afternoon, more than 100 people had indicated online that they planned to attend. Group founder Calvetta Williams said she organized the march after becoming angry once she watched the video of the incident involving Floyd. Hopefully they can see it's not just Minnesota people that are angry and frustrated, she said. We're angry and frustrated with them, and we demand justice even if we're not there. We see them and we're standing with them. Several other Iowans who have dealt with civil rights issues shared their perspective Thursday about Floyd's death and the resulting protest in Minneapolis. Lonnie Porter received a $25,000 settlement in 2018 after he sued the Des Moines Police Department, alleging he was pulled over without reason. Porter, who recorded the 2017 stop on his phone in a video published by the Register, wasn't issued a citation during the roughly 8-minute stop. The officer said he pulled Porter over because a temporary license on the vehicle wasn't fully detectable. The footage shows that the paper license was on the back window of the car. Porter said Thursday that he has encountered multiple situations with police where he believes race was a factor. It's sad that a lot of the officers use a lot of force that's really not needed, Porter said Thursday. A Des Moines resident said he couldn't have witnessed the Minneapolis event without becoming involved. I probably would have been to jail or dead with him. I don't rock like that, Porter said Thursday. Brennan Wells is a student at Drake University and a member of Phi Beta Sigma, an African-American fraternity at the private school. He believes some people have become numb to incidences like this. Wells, 27, called on lawmakers to take action to help eliminate excessive force used by law enforcement. This is an issue for state legislature. They write the criminal code, and they ultimately have more say-so than most people give credit to, Wells said. Alfredo Parrish is the founder and senior partner of the Parrish Scrutineer law firm in Des Moines. His firm has represented multiple race-related cases, including Porter's. Parrish believes some police officers approach African-American males from a different perspective than how they interact with white people. He called for more training. Even though we think we're past this so-called racial divide, I think it's greater than ever because of the leadership in the White House. I think that tends to empower people who are, say, borderline racist or don't know which direction to go. They feel justified in conduct that otherwise would not be appropriate, Parrish said. Des Moines police have denied accusations of systematic bias within the department. There is not a single officer in our organization who isn't shocked and disturbed by what is seen in that video, Sergeant Paul Perzik said Thursday. The Des Moines Police Department does everything possible, our hiring practices, our training, and our service in our neighborhoods, to make sure that our officers, policies, and procedures live up to the community's expectations and the values that we both share. There's a similar article here, Floyd's Death Opens Another Large Wound. This one is from Minneapolis. Bernard Miles has lived in the Powderhorn neighborhood for 30 years and at age 50 said he still fears harassment and aggression from the police. If I had my knee on somebody's neck, I'd already be in prison, he said. He was referring to the incident Monday where Officer Derek Chauvin knelt on George Floyd's neck as the 46-year-old black man gasped for air and said he couldn't breathe. Video of the encounter showed Floyd's last moments and prompted the firing of Chauvin, who is white, and three other officers amid a national outcry. In their neighborhood where Floyd was killed, and in Minneapolis at large, residents and community leaders say a mistrust between police and the black community persists. You cannot talk to any African-American young person, especially a male, who will not have a story about their interactions with police, said Pastor Hans Lee of Calvary Lutheran Church, a block south of the intersection where Floyd died. In nearby Falcon Heights, Minnesota, Philando Castile was fatally shot by a police officer while being pulled over during a traffic stop in 2016. A jury acquitted St. Anthony, Minnesota police officer Geronimo Yanez in Castile's killing. The year before the fatal shooting of Jamar Clark, age 24, by Minneapolis officers responding to a paramedic call led to a protest occupying the area around the department's 4th precinct. After the officers were cleared of wrongdoing, Bob Kroll, head of the city's police union, called Black Lives Matter a, quote, terrorist organization, according to the Star Tribune. Kroll was also at the center of controversy in 2019 when a department policy banned off-duty officers from wearing their uniforms to political events. The change was made before a rally for President Donald Trump, and Kroll responded by selling red Cops for Trump shirts before appearing at the event. In 2010, David Smith, who had bipolar disorder, was held down and restrained by Minneapolis police officers before he died of asphyxiation. Smith was face down, groaning on the floor of a YMCA, as an officer drove his knee into his back and another was on his legs, the Star Tribune reported. The officers involved were cleared of wrongdoing, but the city paid a $3 million settlement to Smith's family. In 2002, Christopher Burns, age 44, was killed when two officers used an authorized chokehold, the Star Tribune reported. I've never known the city of Minneapolis not to have issue with police brutality or over-aggressive policing, said John Thompson, who was friends with Castile and became a prominent activist in the area after his death. Why do I feel this way? Why can't I just be black in the state of Minnesota? Though Thompson says steps were taken toward meaningful reform in the department under the leadership of Police Chief Madaria Arredondo, Floyd's killing could set that progress back. On Wednesday, more than 50 people milled outside Cup Foods at the intersection of 38th Street and Chicago Avenue, the site of Floyd's arrest. Some held signs, others made speeches. Carmen Means, executive director of the Central Area Neighborhood Development Organization, said the intersection is not foreign to tragedy. A young woman was shot there in April. Minneapolis historically has been home to a small but vibrant African-American population. From the 1930s to the 1970s, an African-American neighborhood flourished in the area surrounding the intersection, according to the Minnesota Historical Society. Means said a highway built west of where Floyd was killed divided the neighborhood, and many faced the issue of redlining, the discriminatory denial of services, especially bank loans, to communities of color. The Historical Society said the neighborhood changed from the 1980s to the 2000s, facing higher crime and the crack epidemic. Central High School, Prince's alma mater, closed in 1982. "We don't have a trust for the police in this neighborhood, period," Means said, adding that her community is not an isolated one, but part of a larger mistrust many in the black community feel toward police throughout the city and in the U.S. Moving over to the Metro and Iowa section, petitions started to fight DMPS Stadium. Des Moines residents want the right to vote on $19.5 million plan. The cars rolled through the parking lot at the Birdland Swimming Pool, where they were met with masked volunteers with clipboards and pens in hand. They were there to sign a petition to force Des Moines Public Schools to hold a public vote on its plan to build a $19.5 million football and soccer stadium in partnership with Drake University. This is what grassroots political action looks like in a time when social distancing is at the top of everyone's mind. "We're up against a lot of roadblocks," said Dan Pardock, a Hoover parent who launched the Save Our Stadium's Facebook page. "With the COVID situation right now, we don't feel comfortable doing door-to-door, just grabbing a petition and walking down the street." Instead, the group is organizing mobile petition drives like the one at Birdland earlier this week. It held about a half dozen so far and has four more scheduled for Friday and Saturday. Volunteers are also using the Facebook page to schedule one-on-one appointments with those who want to sign but don't feel comfortable going out in public. "We have volunteers that are driving out to people's houses, putting on their masks, walking up to the door with the petition, gathering their signature, and then hopping back in the car and driving off to the next person's house," Pardock said. The group had collected about 2,250 signatures as of Wednesday night. It needs to reach 5,300 signatures by Tuesday to force a vote. The Des Moines School Board unanimously approved the project on May 19, 6 months after it was first proposed. The 4,000-seat stadium would serve as the home field for the Hoover, Lincoln, North, and Roosevelt football teams. The East High School football team would continue to use Williams Stadium for home games. On Friday nights, when there is more than one home football game scheduled, Drake Stadium would be used as a secondary site, which would bring players and fans from four high schools to the campus. Soccer teams from all five high schools would play some games in the new stadium, and it would be available for activities such as marching band festivals and rugby matches, as well as middle school football and soccer games. Des Moines Public Schools plans to use $15 million from the Secure and Advanced Vision for Education Fund, sales tax revenue dedicated to capital improvements, to build the facility. Drake would fund the remaining $4.5 million through donations and be responsible for maintaining the facility. The new stadium, the district contends, is a cheaper alternative to renovating its three other stadiums that would be Grubb for North, Hutchins for Lincoln, and McCrane for Hoover, and building a standalone stadium for Roosevelt, which currently plays its home games at Drake Stadium. The district estimates those projects could cost a combined $60 million. Kirsten Delgardell, president of the Des Moines School Board, said it wasn't an easy decision to back the combined stadium, but based on what staff had told us the cost would be to renovate all current stadiums and bring them up to ADA compliance, something that has to happen as soon as you begin any new work on the stadium, it's what is fiscally feasible or responsible at this time. Pardock admits there would be significant cost to upgrade Des Moines stadiums. The district has failed to maintain them for two decades, he says, but he questions the district's $60 million estimate. "More importantly, the combined stadium threatens to erode the traditional Friday night football in Des Moines," he said. "We're going to lose that spirit of community," Pardock said. "Some of the students are able to walk to games. People in the community know there's a game going on, so they just head out the door and go. Getting those students and fans to games 2.5 to 4 miles from their schools would be a challenge," he said. Earlier this month, the school board created a committee to review athletic facilities and provide recommendations for future investments with an eye on district-wide equity. Pardock said he and others want the district to put off the stadium project until that group has had time to meet with school principals and athletic directors to ask what improvements they want to see. "We need to take a breath, step back, take a look at the bigger picture, and find out what our schools need. A lot more than a shiny, brand new stadium," he said. And an outbreak at pork plant confirmed. Iowa Department of Public Health Deputy Director Sarah Reister confirmed Thursday the suspected coronavirus outbreak at Tyson Foods' pork processing plant in Storm Lake, where more than 20% of the employees have tested positive. The news came one day after Reister said the state will only publicly confirm coronavirus outbreaks at meatpacking plants or other businesses when asked by members of the media. Reister said Thursday that 555 of the plant's 2,517 employees have tested positive for the coronavirus. That's well beyond the 10% thresholds, Reister said, is requested, although not required, for businesses to report outbreaks to the IDPH. Reister said that percentage is derived from the IDPH's standard for other infectious diseases, and so that's the decision that was made when we entered into COVID. Right now, the Iowa Department of Public Health becomes aware of outbreaks of businesses when the employers tell us or when the state facilitates testing at a particular facility, Reister said at Thursday's press briefing. Businesses are not currently required to report outbreaks to the Department of Public Health. Additionally, Iowa law allows confirmation about outbreaks only when necessary to protect the health of the public. "We've determined confirming outbreaks at businesses is only necessary when the employment setting constitutes a high-risk environment for the potential of COVID-19 transmission." After nearly 500 additional positive cases were reported this week in Buena Vista County, Tyson Foods said Wednesday it has conducted large-scale coronavirus testing at its pork processing plant. Tyson also operates a turkey processing plant in Storm Lake that has approximately 750 employees. The Storm Lake situation is the latest in a string of meatpacking outbreaks in and near Iowa, which halted production and forced additional safety measures at several plants. In the past month, Tyson Foods restarted plants in Columbus Junction, Waterloo, and Perry, and in Dakota City, Nebraska, near Sioux City, after installing additional worker safeguards. Smithfield resumed operation at its largest pork processing plant in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, near Iowa's border, after closing it for nearly a month. And JBS reopened a pork processing plant in Worthington, Minnesota, just across Iowa's border. The state does not make information about meatpacking outbreaks available on its website, coronavirus.iowa.gov, as it does with outbreaks at long-term care facilities. This is despite growing evidence that meatpacking plants are a source of coronavirus outbreaks. Mayra Lopez, vice president of the Storm Lake League of United Latin American Citizens of Iowa, has heard plenty of concerns and frustration regarding the reporting procedures. Lopez has friends and family who are part of the many minority workers at Tyson Storm Lake operations. "I feel that there could have been more adequate steps taken within the pork plant to prevent such a large number of confirmed cases," Lopez told the Register on Thursday. Lopez said she and other community members met with a Tyson Foods Human Resources representative earlier this month, looking for additional information on how to handle coronavirus at the Storm Lake plants. Lopez said the meeting laid out health procedures being taken, but that Tyson, quote, "wasn't as transparent as they could have been," end quote. "We felt like we wanted to be there to support Tyson," Lopez said. "So if there were any gaps that we community members could fill in with our connections, we could maybe help Tyson. I understand the HR person was probably sharing only as much as Tyson was allowing her. We didn't reach a conclusion on how we could help. Tyson made it sound like they have a handle on things. I appreciate them taking the time to meet with us, but the meeting was very short, very scripted, very vague." Lopez added that fear regarding the potential for an outbreak in Storm Lake has been here for a couple weeks, and that something was bound to happen. "I honestly feel like the company has failed its employees," Lopez said. "With 555 cases confirmed, that seems pretty steep. They have opened up a mobile clinic for Tyson employees, but I don't know if that plays a factor with why cases have skyrocketed over the last couple of days. We finally have the testing we've been waiting for. I don't think people are getting results quickly enough. I've heard Tyson employees waiting as long as a week to hear back if they have a confirmed case. By the time they get the results, it could be too late and they've passed it on to someone else. Lopez has fewer concerns at the nearby turkey processing plant in Storm Lake. She believed that management there has addressed prevention concerns better. Meanwhile, at 3:45 p.m. Thursday, the state was reporting 18,584 positive cases and 506 deaths. That's an increase of 224 positive cases and 15 deaths over the previous 24 hours. Iowa's weekly jobless claims could be abating. Figures released Thursday provided a glimmer of hope that new weekly unemployment claims in Iowa may be abating slightly as businesses across the state reopen. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics report said there were 14,586 new claims for the week ending Saturday. That's still slightly above the largest number of weekly claims recorded in Iowa before the COVID-19 pandemic began forcing business shutdowns 10 weeks ago, 14,201 in December of 2000. The report also showed a downward adjustment in the figure for the week ending May 14th. Initially reported as 13,040, it dropped to 12,056 in Thursday's report, a significant decline from the 2000 record. The reason for the adjustment wasn't clear, and the Bureau of Labor Statistics did not respond to a request for an explanation. Since March 17th, when Governor Kim Reynolds ordered the first of a wave of business shutdowns and restrictions to combat the spread of COVID-19, the total number of unemployment claims remains unprecedented. But an Iowa Workforce Development report, also released Thursday, shows continuing weekly unemployment claims slowly declining. For the week that ended Saturday, there were 180,679 continuing unemployment claims for the state. That's nearly 11,000 fewer continuing claims than the state saw at its peak in the first week of May, when there were 191,257 continuing claims filed. Unemployment insurance benefit payments for the week totaled $48.8 million. Iowa Workforce Development Director Beth Townsend said it's too early to draw conclusions about the impact of reopening businesses on unemployment. However, a decline in initial and continuing claims are better than increases and are some indication that more people are no longer in need of unemployment, hopefully because they are returning to work, Townsend said in an email. We will have to see what happens in the coming weeks as more businesses reopen, but hopefully we will see larger and sustained declines in both numbers as a result. Nationally, there were 2.1 million new weekly claims, down from 2.4 million the previous week. Thursday's figures came as Reynolds allowed bars to reopen under restrictions, including keeping customers to 50% of fire code capacity and maintaining at least 6 feet between tables and between patrons and musical performers. Casinos, amusement parks, bowling alleys, pool halls, and arcades are set to open under similar rules next week. Speedways and racetracks can have fans in attendance, and outdoor performance venues can hold live events starting Monday. Last week, Reynolds allowed movie theaters, zoos, aquariums, wedding reception venues, museums, and swimming pools to reopen. Yet some businesses remain closed or are operating with reduced staff. Though restaurants across the state have been allowed to reopen under restrictions since May 15th, many have chosen to continue offering carryout or drive-through service only, saying they do not want to risk the health of employees and customers or that operating dining rooms at half capacity would be economically unfeasible. Iowa's unemployment rate for April was 10.2%, a monthly record despite being well below the national rate for April at 14.7%, the highest since the Great Depression, and up from 4.4% the prior month, and a 50-year low of 3.5% in February. On Wednesday, Iowa Workforce Development released data showing the Des Moines metro area's unemployment rate hit 11.5% in April, up from 3.4% in March. The highest rate was in the Dubuque metro at 12.7%, and the largest percentage increase was in Ames metro, quadrupling to 8.4% from a March unemployment rate of 2.1%. In addition to the manufacturing and accommodations and food services industries, the following industries had the most claims in the latest week numbers for Iowa, according to the Iowa Workforce Development. In manufacturing, they had 3,835. Industries not available that would be self-employed or independent contractors at 2,382. Health Care and Social Assistance, 1,399. Retail Trade, 923. And Accommodations and Food Service at 898. Also in the Metro and Iowa section, Hinterland Music Festival canceled for 2020, but will resume in 2021. This summer's Hinterland Music Festival won't happen because of the coronavirus concerns, but it is slated to resume in 2021, organizers announced on Thursday. Under these conditions, we can't produce the festival to our standards or to our expectations, a news release read. Almost all of this year's lineup is still in for 2021, including headliners Leon Bridges of Monsters and Men and Tyler Childers. The 2021 event is set for August 6th through the 8th. The annual outdoor festival in St. Charles, about 30 miles southwest of Des Moines, would have celebrated its sixth year this summer. We held on as long as we could, festival organizer Sam Summer said. We bring people in from all different states and different countries as well, so to me, it was a pretty clear decision. Summers noted that he couldn't picture a place where everything is back to normal by the time the 2020 event was set to kick off. I don't know how you could have a good experience when everyone is scared of other people right now and trying to stay away from other people, he said. With many artists on the bill simply moving to next year, there's no significant financial devastation, Summers said, but it still sucks for the festival due to its economic impact on the area. The upside, he said, is that Friday will be expanded to a full day of music, allowing for more bands to perform. Also, state officials report a 500th death from COVID-19. Data released by the state shows more than 500 deaths are due to COVID-19, the respiratory disease caused by the novel coronavirus. The state passed the somber milestone, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health data, at 3:23 a.m. Thursday. The number of deaths in Iowa had been creeping up throughout the week. By Thursday afternoon, the state had listed 503 deaths from the virus that is still spreading across Iowa. While the rate of daily new cases in Iowa appears to have begun to decrease since peaking in early May, the rate of deaths in the state has continued to increase, according to state data. Over the past 2 weeks, an average of 13 people have died every day due to the disease in Iowa, a higher average rate of deaths than the state had previously experienced. Polk County, the state's most populous, has reported the most deaths, with 118, according to state data. Other counties with more than 30 deaths include Lynn, with 76, Blackhawk, with 43, Muscatine, with 41, and Woodbury, at 31. Tama County, which has reported outbreaks at meatpacking plant and long-term care facilities, has the highest rate of deaths in Iowa. More than one in every 1,000 residents in Tama County has died due to COVID-19. Older Iowans have been most at risk of dying from COVID-19. While just 5% of infected Iowans are older than 80, that age group has the largest share of coronavirus deaths at 46%. Just 2% of coronavirus deaths in Iowa have been people 40 or younger. The state has reported outbreaks of the virus at 38 long-term care facilities. At those facilities, 1,499 people have tested positive for the virus. Of those, 231 have died, or about 15%, and 646 have recovered, or about 43%. As of 10 a.m. Wednesday, Iowa had reported 18,256 total cases of coronavirus, 9,859 have recovered, and nearly 400 are currently hospitalized. More than 100,000 tests for coronavirus have been conducted in the state. About 1 in 8 of those tests have come back positive. The milestone of 500 deaths comes as Governor Kim Reynolds has moved to lift many of the restrictions, like closing businesses and banning large gatherings, she ordered in recent months. She has said that Iowans should still adhere to social distancing and practice smart health hygiene, which includes staying home when sick and washing hands. University of Iowa researchers have found that the state-ordered social distancing measures help blunt the early surge of cases. But they have warned that Iowa cases could spike as the restrictions are lifted and recommended that Iowans wear face coverings to protect themselves and others. As individuals, we're confronted with an ominous problem on a macro level, but we can use public health information to make decisions at a micro level, Professor Joseph Cavanaugh, head of the university's biostatistics department, wrote in an email to the Des Moines Register. For instance, my own decision as to whether to wear a face mask or face shield in public and whether to adhere to social distancing recommendations may be influenced by an understanding of how these practices could slow the epidemic if widely adopted. Ankeny I-35 exit to close on Tuesday. Work planned to end by early November. Get ready for detours as the Iowa Department of Transportation starts reconstruction Tuesday of I-35's exit 92 interchange at East 1st Street in Ankeny. The exit, along with East 1st Street between Southeast Delaware Avenue and Southeast Creekview Drive, will remain closed until early November, barring weather-related construction delays. Drivers who usually would make use of the exit will be detoured to exit 93 on the Northeast 36th Street interchange, where they can then travel south. Cars on East 1st Street trying to access I-35 will be detoured north on US 69 North Ankeny Boulevard, turning onto Northeast 36th Street to reach the interchange. The East 1st Street interchange will be reconfigured into a diverging diamond according to the Iowa Department of Transportation. This will speed up traffic, which has slowed in recent years because of congestion resulting from Ankeny's rapidly growing population. In a diverging diamond interchange, cars exit the interstate on a road to the left of traffic traveling the opposite direction, then cross back onto the right through a stoplight. This reduces the number of cars that have to wait for traffic signals. In addition to reconfiguring the interchange, the construction crews will grade the roadbed, pave new ramps, and install new traffic signals, lights, and signage. 9 cats found in burned box, 2 with severe wounds. The Animal Rescue League says the prognosis is hopeful. 9 kittens were placed in a box and burned on Des Moines' northeast side recently, 2 of which suffered severe injuries, officials from the Animal Rescue League of Iowa said Thursday. An injured female and an injured male have burns on much of their bodies. The other 7 are healthy despite having singed fur, ARL spokeswoman Stephanie Feiler said Thursday. The kittens are believed to be between 4 to 6 weeks old. While their injuries are severe, their prognosis is hopeful, and the ARL will continue to keep their welfare the number one priority in all decisions made regarding their care and treatment, Feiler said about the 2 badly injured animals. Just after midnight on May 22nd, Polk County Sheriff's deputies were dispatched to the 1500 block of Broadway Avenue because of a fire investigation, said Lieutenant Jeff Rollman. Delaware Township and Sailor Township firefighters also responded. Deputies discovered a small fire a few hundred feet behind a homeless camp and found some of the injured kittens, Rollman said. Later that day, deputies were dispatched to the same address and found more kittens, including one with burns. 2 days later, additional kittens were found by animal control officers, one of which was wounded. The 2 injured kittens were scheduled to undergo surgery Thursday to remove burned tissue. They were receiving pain medication, antibiotics, and eye medication to manage their pain and treat their wounds, according to the news release. Rollman said the case is still being investigated. The case is at least the 3rd known Des Moines Metro animal abuse case in the last 2 weeks. A Des Moines woman was arrested Sunday after allegedly stabbing a cat with a kitchen knife and trying to drown the animal in a bathtub. The woman told police the cat bit her while she showered and she stabbed it in self-defense. A Des Moines man was arrested May 18th after adopting 2 dogs, then leaving them in his apartment without food and water, according to a criminal complaint. Des Moines Public School meals to keep going through summer. Des Moines Public Schools will continue to offer no-cost meals to children at 22 locations during the summer months. The district has provided more than 500,000 no-cost meals since closing school buildings in March to curb the spread of coronavirus in central Iowa, according to a news release. However, we all know the need does not end when summer begins, the release said. For more than 30 years, Des Moines Public Schools has operated a summer food program for children ages 18 and younger. The switch to the summer program will come with some new grab-and-go meal locations. The new sites will begin operating Monday and continue through the end of July. The hours are 11:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. weekdays. The district will reevaluate the sites for August based on the number of meals distributed in June and July. Metro pools, water parks push back dates. The hot weather will have you seek places to swim, but many of the pools around the Des Moines Metro plan to stay closed this summer due to concerns over spreading COVID-19. Though the governor has officially declared public facilities, including pools, may reopen as long as social distancing precautions are taken, many pools, both public and private, are choosing to remain closed. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says there is no evidence that the disease can spread through water, and that the use of disinfectants such as chlorine or bromine should inactivate the virus. However, the CDC still recommends maintaining 6 feet of distance from people you're not living with and wearing cloth masks when not in the water. Here are the official pool closures announced around the Des Moines Metro as of Wednesday. In Des Moines, pools run by the City of Des Moines have delayed their opening, originally scheduled for May 23rd to June 15th. This includes all pools, aquatic centers, splash pools, spray grounds, and wading pools in parks and athletic centers at the 27 aquatic locations run by the city. For more information, visit the City of Des Moines Parks and Recreation website. In Altoona, Altoona's Aquatic Center and Park, both operated by the Greater Altoona Community Service Campus, have announced changes to their seasonal plans. The Altoona Campus Indoor Pool is officially open as of Tuesday. Visitors can use the pool, open from 5 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. and from 4 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. Monday through Friday, and from 7 to 11:30 a.m. Saturdays for lap swimming, but not for water classes, water walking, or recreational play. The Outdoor Aquatic Park postponed its planned June 6 opening indefinitely. There will be an update on its status when further information becomes available, according to a news release. The City of Ames announced Wednesday it was uncertain when or if we will be able to safely and responsibly open the city's aquatic facilities. Furman Aquatic Center and the Municipal Pool in Ames will remain closed until further notice. Currently, all Ankeny City Aquatic Centers are closed and programs are suspended until further notice. The city said staff is working with the Iowa Department of Public Health, the CDC, the American Red Cross, Ankeny City Council, and the Governor's Office to determine ways to safely open pools and offer lessons this summer. The Clive Aquatic Center, which typically operates from Memorial Day weekend through mid-August, will remain closed for 2020 because of the pandemic. If public health conditions and directives from state leaders change by early summer, the city may offer limited swimming lessons in July. Those who purchase swimming passes for the Aquatic Center will receive refunds beginning May 19th. The Pleasant Hill Aquatic Park will remain closed until further notice, according to the city's Park and Recreation Department. All programs scheduled for this summer have been delayed or suspended, including swimming lessons, aquatic fitness, and lifeguard training classes, lap swim and swim team practices. If you have enrolled in a class that will be canceled due to COVID-19, the full fee will be returned to your account for future use, or you can request a refund to a credit card on file by contacting the department. The Urbandale Indoor Swimming Pool will remain closed until at least July 6, according to the city's Park and Recreation Department. And all of West Des Moines' aquatic facilities are closed until further notice due to the COVID-19 outbreak. And that does it for the first hour of the Register on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Up next, we'll give a shout-out to all our listeners who are celebrating a birthday today. I'm your reader, Dennis May. Thanks for listening.